Hello, and welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Coram Deo Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, our topic is a Christian's relationship to culture.
And Mike, just to be clear, First City Church is in Bellevue, Nebraska.
Yeah.
Not
that's right.
Not Omaha.
Bellevue. Not the other First City Church that's in Nebraska.
Right, yeah.
The
yeah.
one in Bellevue.
Right, the one in Bellevue.
Yeah.
A Christian's relationship to culture. Here's our reason for tackling this topic. A bunch of you listeners have been sending in, like, political questions, which I understand your reason for doing so, right? It's an odd year. It's going to be an odd next 30 days or so.
It's really clear who we should all vote for.
So we've just been getting a lot of questions about, like, hey, politics, cultural engagement. This even connects to questions of racial injustice. How do we engage in the world in the midst of racism, racial injustice, some of the events that have gone on recently in issues of law enforcement using force against people. There, a lot of these things are connected to the question of just what does it mean for Christians to engage culture? And we want to introduce a simple concept that we got from James Davison Hunter, who is a professor at the University of Virginia. It's the concept of faithful presence. Some listeners will be familiar with this. Some of you, it's the first time you've heard of it. The concept of faithful presence. James Davison Hunter's thesis, he wrote a book called To Change the World back in 2010. His thesis is this: a Christian's job, a Christian's calling in the world is to be faithfully present within the culture. Faithfully present, not meaning distinct, right? So faithful, like I'm living out the values of the kingdom of God while present in a culture that does not embrace those values. So that's the idea, faithful presence. Let us tease it out for you a little bit, and then we want to try to just talk about how it applies to what it looks like lived out, all right? So James Davison Hunter is working in about a 70 or 80 year stream of thought about, especially in America, how should Christians engage culture. He summarizes the sort of stream of thought this way. He says there are four or three dominant answers to the question, how should a Christian relate to the culture? Okay. One is the defensive, he calls it the defensive against posture, which is Christians need to be defensive against the world. So this is sort of classic fundamentalism. This is the world is coming against us, and our answer is we need to defend ourselves against the onslaught of the world. So it has a little bit of a protectionist flavor to it, a little bit of a defensive flavor to it. It's sort of, man, let's put up the walls and put up the gates and buckle down for this onslaught that's coming at us from the culture. That shouldn't be surprising to many of you because that stream has been present in Christianity for about 100 years now. If not longer, but in American Christianity especially, the last 100 years have sort of been defined by a lot of that defensiveness toward the culture. He says there's a reaction against that that he calls the relevant to camp. A Christian's calling is to be relevant to the culture. We need to engage the culture by showing how relevant we are and connected we are to the culture around us. So let's be involved in the culture. Let's be local. Let's engage and let's sort of do our best to make Christianity relevant, which obviously has the unintended effect of we start compromising the gospel in our desire to be relevant. And again, that story is well documented over the course of the past few decades, ways that churches and the church have sort of, in our desire to be relevant, gone off the rails. Okay. Then there's a third tradition, and this tradition is actually interesting. It's sort of an Anabaptist tradition coming out of the Radical Reformation, and it's the purity from, he calls it purity from culture. And it's not, it's different from defensive against because it actually doesn't see the culture as a threat. It just sees the culture and the church as almost like different streams. So the idea is our goal is purity from the culture. Our goal is to just embrace a whole different mindset and a whole different way of living, and in a sense to sort of keep the DNA of the kingdom of God pure. So separationist, not isolationist, but separationist. Let's step out of the culture. And so these are the people who like would be in favor of no political engagement at all. No, you know, who cares who gets elected in office? That's not the church's job. The church's job is sort of to preach the gospel and sort of be separate from the culture. Hunter, though he has affinity for all of those streams, says that there's a there's sort of a, of course, his way is the best way. The fourth way, the James Aveson Hunter way, is what he calls faithful presence. And in a sense, it takes cues from all of these. It's a way of being relevant. It's also a way of being pure. It's also a way of defending. Essentially, what he says is this. If you look at, for instance, books like Daniel in the Bible, right? You have Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who are all in Babylon, in the king's court, in exile, and yet they say, hey, can we have permission not to eat the king's meat? Can we have permission not to defile ourselves with this diet? What they're trying to do is they're seeking to be faithfully present. So they're not fleeing Babylon, but nor are they accommodating to Babylon. They're sort of being faithful to the Lord while being present in Babylon. And that's sort of his matrix or mindset for this. And so here's what's interesting about this. And again, Hunter has stirred up a really good conversation over the past 6 years about this. What's interesting is I think it gives us a way of thinking about what does it mean for you to be a missionary in your neighborhood? What does it mean for you to be a missionary in your workplace? What does it mean for you to be a missionary in your school system? What does it mean to be present within culture and yet not defined by the patterns and emphases of culture? How do we remain present and yet live by a different set of values? Because we don't want to withdraw from culture, then we're just sort of taking the salt and light out of the culture. But we also don't want to seek relevance in a way that sort of just blends us with the culture and waters down the distinctness of the Christian message. And so Hunter's really, he's saying what we want is to be distinctly Christian, yet present within a world that is not so.
This book was incredibly formative to my thinking when I read it a few years back. And what particularly struck me about the book is when he gets into this idea of all these different camps and how they want to engage culture, that all of them in some way, shape, or form are reduced to power struggle. So if you are one that wants to try to be relevant to or try to transform the culture, or even if you're defensive against the culture, it all boils down to some degree, a power struggle where you are either posturing yourself trying to change, and so you're grabbing for structural places where you can try to change, so whether that be politics or art or music or whatever it is, and you have to combat against those forces and influences you're against, or if you retreat into a defensive posture, you still have to fight to keep those forces out. And so while there is a level of you can't ever get away from that, if that becomes what we're focused on, it completely misses the point of what it means to engage culture in a way that is distinctly Christian. The other thing that he says that was, it's almost like stating the obvious, but it was kind of like blew up my mind, is when he has this great point that he makes that for us to think that we can change culture is an incredibly arrogant thing, in that it gives this impression that we can control history and that we can pull enough levers, we can influence things enough to where we define and we sort of steer the rudder of history. And he gives this great example of the Reformation. Everybody thinks here was Martin Luther, this man of incredible bravery and intelligence, and he goes up and he pounds his 95 thesis on the door of the church and sparks this incredible revolution. It's like, look what he did. Well, what Hunter points out is that there were probably dozens of would-be Martin Luthers that came before him. And because that sort of cultural situation around them wasn't ripe for revolution, they failed completely. It wasn't that Luther was this distinct leader that was far surpassed everybody in the past. It was that there were things swirling around Luther that he struck when the iron was hot. So it wasn't that Luther necessarily controlled history. He just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And so there's this sense where when Christians posture themselves in this overly optimistic, hey, we can change culture, we get caught up into this idea that, man, we have more power than we do. And then when we don't have the power we think we do, we start to get into this power play and struggle and things go sideways. So those were some of the things when I read this book that really kind of shook my thinking about how we engage culture.
So this is what's interesting to me in all the questions we're getting from listeners about the election is they sort of all boil down to like, should I vote for Trump, Hillary, or neither, or the Libertarian guy or the Constitution Party? Like, who do I vote for? And it sort of relates to, like, how should I leverage my power and influence as a voter? That's not a bad question.
Right, right.
But what it does imply a certain understanding of cultural change. And I want to put words in James Davison Hunter's mouth, but I wonder if he would just say, well, who cares? Like, at the end of the day, pulling the levers of who's in office in Washington, though that does matter, is not the vehicle that by which Christ is going to change the world.
Yeah.
There's a faithful presence we're called to be in the world, whether our candidate wins or not, or whether we like any candidate or not, or whether we're Christians are in power or marginalized. The calling is the same, which is to be faithfully present in the places where God has put us. Now, I think it's a provocative idea, and it was actually the book, again, was really helpful to me as well. I'm wondering, like, yeah, but what does it mean to be faithfully present as a senator or as a, like, in
yeah,
a sense,
exactly.
If you're in a position of power, don't you, it doesn't necessarily resolve the questions you have to ask, Chris, of like, okay, well, let's say I'm the governor, let's say I'm the mayor, let's say I'm a city council member. I'm in a position of power, and I have to start asking questions about how do I rightly leverage this power? So, I don't know. It seems like Hunter sort of, he's casting a broad net. And rightly so, but I feel like he leaves some of those questions a little bit unanswered.
Yeah, and what's interesting to that, though, is that he puts a lot of emphasis on top-down change, where he's reacting against a lot of the thought at the time was that change happens grassroots and it sort of bubbles up from the bottom. And his point was, no, actually, if you are not in
if
you're not in the elite places of power, then there's no hope in a sense to change. You have to have those institutional places of power, and you have to have influence there. So there is a sense where he is going to argue that Christians need to be faithful presence in those places of power. So in Washington or state and local level of politics, or pulling the levers of art and literature and music and things like that shape. But I think he's also pointing out that if Christians aren't careful, they can reduce their function in those places to thinking, I have to keep and maintain power if I'm going to affect change. And the impression I got when I read the book is he's really trying to steer Christians away from getting caught up in the same old sort of power play.
Grab the levers of power so I can push it in the direction of godliness. Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing there too is that I think a lot of Christians are assuming that we've all of a sudden lost power. Like we had the power.
We had it,
and now all of a sudden it's gone. And so we got to figure out how to get it back. And so there's a sense of despair when in fact we didn't have the power in the beginning. So I think there's been some misguidedness along that.
How does everything that you guys have been saying tie into what we've talked about in the past with like the Benedict option? And
I was just thinking of that same question.
The way that idea kind of gives a grid for people, for Christians to live in a society that doesn't necessarily accept them.
Yes, this is fascinating because I've been also reading lately Stanley Hauerwas, who James Davison Hunter would say is sort of a purity front. He's an Anabaptist guy.
Anabaptist.
He's sort of a let's sort of just be the church. You know, that's Hauerwas's call. And as I read the book, I'm just like, well, that's great, but what does it mean to be the church? Like, you can say that's a great slogan, but what exactly does that mean? Be the church, you know? And I think he's just saying maintain a robust community. He's sort of, I think Rod Dreher in the Benedict Option stuff is sort of in that same strain of, hey, our job is to preserve Judeo-Christian value system in the midst of a culture that is not going to preserve it for us. Okay, so, but I do think it's interesting to ask how would James Davison Hunter's point of view and the Benedict Option stuff interface? And I think as I've thought about that, part of my answer, Mike, is just to say I think it's a different way of being faithfully present. I think it's still because the reason he called it the Benedict Option is because he's leaning on the Benedictines, the order of monks. And the Benedictines are very present in the world. They're not, though they are cloistered in the sense they're monks, so they've renounced the world in some ways, they're still very active in education and in charity and in benevolence. And they're very immersed in and active in the world. They're just operating by a different set of values. And so it's interesting to me that I think that Benedict Option stuff actually fits into a rightly understood vision of faithful presence, because it's just a longer term. It's basically saying part of what it means to be faithfully present in the world is to lean on the faithful side of that equation. Mm-hmm. And to be faithful, if the culture sort of abandoned any care for Judeo-Christian ethics or even history, we can't abandon that stuff. We have to continue to be faithful to pass that on to our kids.
I was having a fascinating conversation with my barber today. And
I saw you have a nice haircut, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks. And we were just talking about like the renaissance over the last 10 years of the barbershop.
Yeah.
Like what brought that on? And so I asked him, I said, what happened back in history that made the barbershops kind of go away? And he said, the Beatles. So
wow.
every white,
blame it on the Beatles.
Every white teenage boy wanted to be a Beatle, right? And so they stopped cutting their hair in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, right?
Those hippies.
Nobody cut their hair for like 10 years.
90s grunge, you know, everybody's growing out their hair.
It's only stuff you learn in barber school.
Yeah. Yeah. But what he said was, so I asked him, I said, well, so barbers didn't just like come out of nowhere. Like what happened? He said, well, the African American community didn't stop barbering. He said, those dudes just kept barbering no matter what the society was doing with hairstyles. Those little communities of neighborhoods still gathered around the barbershop.
Yeah,
I just thought that was fascinating. Like, oh, that's kind of what we're talking about here is like, no matter what society's doing, we're going to commit
the same thing
to tradition and whatever
we're
hold to. Mm-hmm. And no matter the tides and the ebbs and flows of society and culture, we're going to remain the same.
Yes. And one of the fascinating things in Hunter's book is he points to the Jewish community and the gay community.
Hmm.
And he just says, what's unique about those two communities? What's unique is they're 2-3% of the population. Hmm. And yet they have this dominant voice. Like you think about how, like think about anybody trying to get elected to public office without showing up at the Jewish Political Action Committee conference, you know, like, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you have to sort of pay homage to what's our stance on Israel. Why? Because the Jewish people really care about that, right? And he's like, why does the gay community exert so much influence in culture? Well, it is because they don't necessarily care what the rest of the culture is doing. They're saying, we want to push forward a particular vision of life and of sort of passing on a set of convictions. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting that Hunter's saying you don't have to be a majority of the population to have a significant influence if you really are faithfully maintaining something that really matters to people, which your barbershop thing is sort of in that same vein.
Yeah.
You know, every African-American friend I have, man, the barbershop on Saturday morning is like, that's where you go to like hang out, talk, hear all the news, chat it up with guy. Like, it's amazing how dominant that institution is in African-American culture. And it does preserve a sense of the uniqueness of that sort of cultural paradigm.
So it seems that this also sort of changes the focus of what are we going after? Oftentimes we can slip into a pragmatism. So the voting question.
Yes.
The question is,
who's going to change the world in the next 4 years?
Yeah. I mean, and so it all
no
sort
way.
Of, the arguments all sort of become this pragmatic sense of, well, if we don't vote certain person in, then we're going to lose all these Supreme Court justices, and then
which that actually is going to happen. So I'm
right.
going to fight you.
Yeah, I mean, so okay, so that's
that
the reality. So, but then okay,
we should talk about
matter?
Why that doesn't matter to Chris.
Well, it matters.
That's a whole another podcast.
But does it matter to the degree that we have to place that principle, that outcome, above all other things?
Yeah, good question. That's a key question.
So, and I think Hunter would push against that sort of pragmatism, that we have to engage the culture and make decisions based upon that sort of pragmatism. Now, that doesn't eliminate the wrestle. I think that's an important question, and we do need to wrestle through those things. But at the same time, if that is not the defining principle by which we engage culture, then it changes things. I don't have to make a vote based upon merely pragmatic reasons.
Well, here's another funny example. I can't remember if I mentioned this on the podcast before. Dusty's off the mic over here, like just sitting back and yelling.
Sitting back watching this, watching Chris get fired up.
I can't remember if I told this story on the podcast before, but I have a friend who retreats regularly at this Catholic monastery, and he was talking to one of the monks there, and I don't remember what they were talking about. But the monk said, you Protestants, he sort of chuckled at him, you Protestants think in terms of decades.
Yeah.
We Catholics think in terms of centuries.
Yeah.
and it really is like this. You don't see a whole lot of Roman Catholics real nervous about stuff because they're just, they understand, I think, at least institutionally, the slow long-termness of change. And so it's interesting how there's just sort of this, it does seem that especially in evangelicalism, and I think because of its sort of activist roots, there tends to be a lot of nervousness about the next 4 years or the next 2 years or the next election cycle or what's going on right now, versus a question of what does it mean to be faithful over the next 100 years. And if we faithfully passed the faith on to kids and made disciples for 100 years, if we just did the job of the church and made disciples and were faithfully present in the culture and had a vision for 100 years from now instead of 10 years from now, would that change maybe some of the things we do and the decisions that we make?
Here's a great quote from the book. And again, kind of talking about what you mentioned, Bob, what does it mean to, rather than focusing so much on sort of these immediate pragmatics, but what does it mean just to be faithful over time and the results that that brings? So this is what he writes. Insofar as Christians acknowledge the rule of God in all aspects of their lives, their engagement with the world proclaims the shalom to come. Such work may not bring about the kingdom, but it is an embodiment of the values of the coming kingdom and is thus a foretaste of the coming kingdom. Even while believers wait for their salvation, the net effect of such work will be a contribution not only to the good of the Christian community, but to the flourishing of all. So this idea that if we just faithfully be present for 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years, and that sort of becomes our focus, what does it mean to be present in whatever calling we have? So whether we're the blue-collar worker all the way up to seats of power and cultural influence, that if we have this idea of being faithfully present and modeling the values of the kingdom and the shalom to come, that we may not bring about the kingdom and we may not even like do this whole scale cultural transformation, but there is going to be good that comes from it.
Well, it's interesting to think about the difference between bringing the kingdom and bearing witness to the kingdom, right? Because in a sense, Christians in America seem to have been motivated by this vision of we can bring the kingdom, or it's our job to bring the kingdom. Actually, our job is to bear witness to the existence of a greater kingdom. And if we sort of embrace that bearing witness idea, maybe it gives us a way of having a longer term vision for the slowness of change. And even for embracing periods of persecution, periods of darkness, periods of, I think about Eastern Europe, right? There's a lot of Christians in places like Poland and Hungary and all the Eastern, old Soviet bloc countries. And all they did for 60 or 70 years was they just went underground and were faithful Christians, and 70 years later, the Berlin Wall falls and Soviet sort of empire crumbles. And what emerges in those cultures? Well, some faithful Christians who've been there the whole time, they just had to endure some dark political realities for quite a season.
As I'm just listening, mostly thinking about discipleship is the same thing, right? Like I just have a long, I mean, that's really what we're saying about Christian discipleship too. And so you're saying essentially the same thing today, which is I just need to have a slow, realistic, long-term picture about change as a Christian in culture, which is similar to how I change as a disciple and grow and sanctify.
The challenge for me, Chris, and maybe I'd love to hear your thoughts on this question. So I'm trying to be faithfully present as a teacher in the public school system or as a city council member or as a, right? I'm in a position of power or a position of authority or a position where, for instance, all the sort of transgender stuff that's coming down the pike right now, right? There's a study that was just released last week that I hope we can talk about on a future podcast of some researchers basically saying, if you study the science on gender, it's telling us the exact opposite of where all the legislation is going right now. It's telling us gender is binary, it's not fluid, and the more we treat it as fluid, the more damage we do to people psychologically. So it's really interesting, but I guess what I'm saying is, so if I'm thinking human flourishing and I'm thinking like, how do I bear witness to the kingdom in a way that helps humans flourish? I sit back and go, well, helping people embrace reality when it comes to gender is an important part of that. So what's my job when the Omaha Public Schools is passing this sort of transgender thing? Is it show up at the meetings and yell? Is it sort of subversively work from underneath? Like what? I think that still leaves those pragmatic questions, because I think even
start
if I...
Start your own school.
Yeah, start my own school. I just think like it still leaves those questions. And that's where like I think some people who listen to this podcast are asking, okay, well, great. I love the idea of faithful presence. I still have this question of what does it mean for me to show up as a principal at my public school and be faithfully present? Does that mean I need to take a stand on something? Does it mean I need to make my voice heard in some way? Or do I just sort of sit back and... go for transgender locker rooms and faithfully be present as a Christian in the midst of that? You know, like that's a tough question to answer for me.
Yes, we do not eliminate these tough questions, and it doesn't make the problems go away. It doesn't make the challenge of being faithfully present in culture go away. I mean, this really is a challenge. This is hard. There is contention and there's drift against Christian values in our culture. And so we can't ever just sort of say, oh, faithfully present, and that solves all of our problems. But I wonder this is how I would
I feel
maybe
like you're
answer
my question with a question.
Yes.
You're going to answer my question with a question.
That was a good political move.
Yes. A serious question involves a serious answer. And so I need to ramp up. So I wonder if it looks like doing the things that you said, so being a prophetic voice to reality, so if we're talking about the transgender issue, it involves voicing what is right, but recognizing that I don't need to do so in a way that discredits my witness and testimony to Christ. And so if I'm going to be a prophetic voice in the school system, I don't need to be an angry prophetic voice. I don't need to be a hostile one where it seems like the urgency and the fear of losing something overrides my hope and my belief that the kingdom of God is here.
Oh, that's good right there.
So I think that's where we often go sideways, is that what it starts as maybe a prophetic voice and prophetic witness turns into a play for power. And this is where, again, this concept where I think some of the Anabaptists are right, that the church in many ways is an institution that eschews power. We don't go after power. Our witness is subversive in the fact that, hey, to be a prophetic influence, I don't need to be in all the halls of power. We can do this in a different way because the kingdom of God is here. So that's where I wonder if you're in the school system, maintaining a prophetic voice in a godly way, but if the time comes where perhaps you've sort of spoken your piece and you've tried to be faithful, and that includes, hey, you have to lose your job, or that means you may have to pull out, then maybe that you sort of give up a place of power because you recognize, hey, I no longer can stay here. I can no longer support what's happening here. And you say, I'm gonna pursue other means. I don't know. So there's a piece. Yeah.
Here's what's interesting about that is I meet with some guys weekly to do sermon prep, some other pastors from other churches. And one of them is preaching through Daniel. And we were talking about Daniel 3, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. And he said he was reading this non-Christian literary scholar who writes about biblical literature. She's a fascinating individual. And she says that the way the story is told, you know, you remember the story is King Nebuchadnezzar sets up this idol and is like, everybody's going to bow down to the idol. And the way the story is told is like everybody else in the story besides Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are sort of automatons. Like the whole story is set up in the way that just whatever King Nebuchadnezzar says, all these other people are going to do because they're just sort of like in the machine. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what sets them apart is there's an individuality. There's a reflectiveness. There's a consciousness and a willingness to ask questions and go, no, we're not going to do that. And so it's interesting even to think about the nature of how culture works, that it sort of does have that sort of power to it where it's like, man, there's a lot of people around us who are just going to do whatever the culture tells them to do. So if the government says transgender bathrooms, great, we're going to do that because that's just, we're just automatic. We're not differentiated people. We just do whatever keeps things safe and keeps the government off our back and keeps our life happy. And Christians are, in a sense, called to be the discerning voices, the people who can step back and reflect and go, oh, and the questions you're asking, Chris, of when is it right to be the prophetic voice? When do I have to say, oh, I got to leave my job here because I can't implement, you know, I've reached a point where my conscience won't let me work here with clarity anymore. That's the kind of discernment that the gospel invites us to, is sort of those, that really deep, wise reflectiveness rather than sort of the automatic, and that automatic thing manifests itself in, I think, what you said about the Christian point of view that comes across with anger and sort of vindictiveness and like brittleness. It's a different kind of automation, right? There's the cultural automatons who just do whatever the government says. There's the Christian automatons who are like, well, that's wrong, so we're all gonna, you know, there's sort of a, I guess I'd call it like a shallow Christian response and a more reflective or discerning Christian response.
And I think underneath a lot of that is fear of losing power. So if we want to use the example of voting here again, and hey, if you have someone you're going to vote for that is in the major political parties, okay, you have your reasons, cool. But one of the things you could, I think I would argue to a degree is, if my conscience as a Christian is violated by, you know, the two sort of major political parties, and the argument that, hey, if you don't vote for this particular person, the Supreme Court justices, well, I can take a step back and say, that may be the case, but if my largest concern is not necessarily maintaining power, it is more a faithful presence in, then I can make the argument, hey, that may be true, but my ultimate hope isn't in that power, being able to hold on to that power and influence it on that level. And so I don't have to violate my conscience or violate my my sense of what I should do politically, what it means to be a Christian and vote for, you know, someone that I can in good conscience say, hey, yeah, I actually support this person. So I don't have to be drawn into the power struggle. I think that's another way this plays out. I'll leave
it. Man, that makes a whole, that's a whole nother podcast right there. Because it makes me want to say, okay, I'm with you, but I don't buy that that's an avoiding of the power struggle. Isn't it just a different chopping up of the power?
Or it's not, I'm not led by, I have to, if I don't do X, I'm going to lose power. That I don't have to be drawn into that argument. That I don't need to see holding on to power in a particular area as always necessary. Maybe that's the way I'd put it.
Yeah, right, but... Well, I think I'm just wondering, is your example, because I could say I actually have concern about the Supreme Court, not for reasons of power, but for reasons of truth. Of just like, man, if you start getting a court that doesn't care about reality, I feel like that takes sort of public morality in a real negative direction, which again, I don't need power to fix that problem. I'm fine living in a world where everything's haywire. I just think if I'm standing back going, what responsibility do I have to try to prevent that? I feel like, well, I have some
responsibility. No, that's a good point. And I think that's a fair point and a fair argument. You just have to make the assumption of, you know, if I'm going to pull the lever one way or another, is that going to result in a particular direction on the Supreme Court? So, man, I think that's fair.
Now we should do the podcast about politics, because I'm feeling it right now.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in. And we pray that the things that we've talked about might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We encourage you to go to our website, cdomaha.com/TWC. Check out all the episodes that we've done on the Benedict option for reference to other things that we've talked about today. And we hope that you can join us next Wednesday for another Wednesday Conversation.